This is Jim Perry, host of Euphemet, and I wanted to share some exciting news with listeners today as we launch the Euphemet Patreon. Many of you may have listened to the show since its original inception in 2015. Others have joined us last year or even this week, maybe even today. Well, what is for sure is that the original series that ran from 2015 to early 2018 has been unavailable and under lock and key for nearly a year. Until now. Starting today, members of our new Patreon group will have access to the Euphemet original series episodes, a new old classic released every week that is over 40 exclusive episodes of the original experimental paranormal series, which features in-depth interviews, audio docs, and adventures. And this week, we look back at our first conversation with Greg Newkirk on the notorious Kentucky Goblin case. That's right, it's the inciting incident for the popular documentary series Hellier, and I'll play a portion of that in this very announcement episode in just a bit. But first, if you haven't heard of Patreon, it's a subscription membership platform where we'll have three different membership tiers available, each offering unique and exclusive content that gets you closer to this very project and directly helping in producing new work on paranormal stories. The classic Kentucky Goblins episode will be our first archive release, but Patreon members will receive much more. In the initial tier entitled The Society of Euphemet, members gain access to exclusive podcast feed, featuring not only an original series episode each week, but a brand new long-form interview series, House of Mystic Mirrors, which features long-form interviews with thought leaders, writers, and investigators on all things esoteric. Patreon is an entirely opt-in situation. Listeners can still expect Obscura and a season 2 of Euphemet for free on this very podcast feed. But what Patreon does is directly support those who work on this show. Euphemet, entering into season 2 and introducing Obscura, House of Mystic Mirrors, and the original series, is a project without a network, without a budget, and will now, more than ever, rely on the support from our community. We will rely on you to help us continue telling these stories. It is the most direct form of co-manifestation, of co-creation. We now have the opportunity to really do this together. You can learn more about what we offer members and our three membership tiers at patreon.com/euphemet. But I really wanted to give you something more than an ad here. So what follows is an excerpt. It was March 2016, and Greg was still reeling from receiving mysterious messages from unknown individuals. They called for help. They told of high strangeness, caves, creatures. The whole situation was overwhelming. What you will hear is the story that kicked off the Kentucky Goblins phenomenon, the episode that kicks off Hellier, right now. In 2012, a defunct ghost hunting group's derelict website received an email from this guy in Kentucky. This guy, who we will call David, was panicked. His family's property was being terrorized and David needed help. So the Ghost Hunter Incorporated's website was so old that it hadn't even been updated in like 8 years. It's gone now. But in 2012, David was lucky enough to have one of the members of the ragtag operation still occasionally checking the site's email account. And he happened to be Greg Newkirk, who over the years since the group's demise turned into a big-time investigator of the paranormal. Along with his co-adventurer and wife Dana, they've appeared on national talk radio shows, have a traveling occult museum, lecture events, and even operate their own investigative website. It was just David's luck that he may have found the right guy for the job.
Hello, my name is David. I received your contact information through a mutual acquaintance who assures me that you are well equipped to investigate peculiar problems. Furthermore, I believe you may have interest in these events beyond any compensation that I am prepared to deliver in order to have these issues sorted. For the past 6 months, I have been living in a rural home located on the border of West Virginia and Kentucky, where my family is nightly assaulted by creatures that I have come to believe are of an extraterrestrial origin. These beings appear to be the size and stature of a small child, devoid of any facial features save for large, oily eyes and lipless mouths. They frighten my children by peering through their bedroom windows, chirping at one another. They actively attempt to enter my home in the middle of the night. Last month, they took my dog. The police refused to provide any further assistance, attributing the problems to wild animals and forwarding my complaints to the State Game Commission. I believe that they are coming from an abandoned mine located on the edge of my property. Though I am armed, I'm afraid that I'm far too frightened to enter the mine by my lonesome and cannot convince any sympathetic friends to accompany me, though I cannot blame them. I am convinced that the only answer is to collapse the mine. I believe this is where we can be mutually beneficial to one another. If you are prepared to assist me in this matter, I can offer you permission to record and document these events under the condition of anonymity. I can guarantee you evidence of these creatures, which I assure you are not wild animals. Please respond ASAP. Thank you.
So, Greg thought it was a joke. How and why did this guy entrust GHI with investigating his claim in the first place? I'm actually looking at this picture of GHI. It's taken in 2000. Greg and his compatriots look like they're probably in high school and have maybe just come back from an insane clown posse show. Two of the members hold handguns, other brandish axes of various size. Greg and one other member have matching zebra print bowling shirts. They were, as Greg put it in an article, 110% professional. Greg emails David back. He asks him for more details and evidence. He then posted the email to a paranormal message board that he frequented, as well as his Facebook account, and it quickly became a subject of fun speculation. Everyone had questions. Who is this guy? Why would he email a ghost hunting group for a space alien problem? Who was this mutual friend? Why would spacefaring beings be living in a cave? Is blowing up an abandoned mineshaft even legal? And of course, the question anyone with a passing interest in the paranormal was asking themselves: what if he's telling the truth? The next day, GHI had a message from David.
Thank you for your prompt response. I do not blame you for being skeptical of my story. I appreciate you keeping an open mind about my situation, and I am more than happy to provide you with as much information as I am able. I was given your contact information through a man by the name of Terry Rist. When these disturbances first began occurring, I was only inclined to confide in a personal friend who I knew had fringe interests. He offered to share my concerns with a man that had dealt with somewhat similar experiences in previous years. I accepted his offer. Within a week, I was informed that this gentleman had long since retired from pursuits of this kind, but was willing to provide me with contacts who may be willing to help. This is how I came to contact you. I do not have any answer to why, other than a referral and a recommendation from a gentleman I do not know personally. I was under the impression that you would answer that question. I am located in Pike County, just outside of Kentucky. It's located roughly 30 to 60 minutes from the borders of Virginia and West Virginia, respectively. Most of Pike County is made up of small towns and rural communities. It is not uncommon to go days without seeing my closest neighbors. I moved to this area for the peace and quiet. I have received neither. I have lived in this area for just under 7 months, and in that time the majority of the harassment has occurred within the past three. I did not become aware of any strangeness until early December, although that is only when I began to keep a record of these events. At first it was merely strange tracks in the snow around my home. I had initially imagined that they were some kind of animal, though it closely resembled a human footprint minus the heel. At that time, I was under the impression that it was simply a single creature. It wasn't until weeks later that I began to suspect that I was dealing with a number of what I thought were individuals hazing me upon my arrival to the area. At this point, I was incapable of keeping my dogs outdoors overnight. Any attempt to leave her unleashed would result in her barking herself hoarse until she was allowed back indoors. In the weeks leading up to this particular evening, I had awoken to find my shed doors open on several occasions. Many of my children's toys missing or moved, and my yard in general disarray. I had already given a report to the police, who were making it increasingly clear that they were not interested in my case barring physical harm or large-scale theft. The second week of January, I am having breakfast with my family when my 5-year-old daughter begins talking about kids without hair. When my wife inquired about these kids, she informed us that she had spent the previous night watching them play in the yard. As you can imagine, this was some concern. I asked my daughter what these kids looked like. She told me that they were bald like Grandpa and weren't wearing any clothes. The very same day I found the wreath that hangs inside our rear porch stuffed into our mailbox. I purchased and installed motion-activated floodlights the following day, and for a time, the problem ceased. It wasn't until the end of February that our daughter informed us that the bald kids had returned. I was awoken to the sound of my daughter screaming, rushed to her bedroom only to meet her halfway down the hall. When my wife and I were finally able to calm her down enough to speak, she told us that the kids were trying to peer into her window, but they couldn't reach and instead had taken to tapping on it. She hasn't slept in her own bedroom since. It was that morning that I phoned the police for the second time, and they responded by finally sending a trooper to our residence. I informed him of the regular mischief, how I was unable to let my dogs outdoors after dusk, and of the bald kids. When we found the ground disturbed just under my daughter's bedroom window, the officer informed me, very matter-of-factly, that we were dealing with an animal, and I would be better off contacting the game commission than waste their resources any further. Almost every day for the following week, I would find some evidence that something or someone had been on my property the previous night. Smudges on the windows were not uncommon. Stones from the walkway dragged to the other side of the lawn, and I had found tears in the screen door. On Wednesday, the 7th of March, I finally witnessed the kids without hair for myself. The dog woke me up around 1:30 a.m., scratching at the back door and whimpering to be let out. I noticed that the motion floodlight was on and went to the kitchen window to check that the shed doors were still closed when I realized I could see the shadow of an individual cast across my lawn. From the angle I was positioned at the window, I could not actually see the source of the shadow or the floodlights. The dog was pacing circles around the back door, and I could hear someone rifling through a box on the porch. Filled with a little more anger than common sense, the only reaction I could muster was to bang loudly on the window and yell, at which point I heard the screen door on the porch swing open and slam against the house. I heard what I can only describe as chirping at this point. It sounded much like a skunk, if more guttural. I then realized that there were more than two people on my property, and the shadow, which had been reacting as if it didn't know which way to run, was quickly joined by another. For a moment, I watched as the shadows chirped at one another when I noticed a figure out of the corner of my eye. Standing in the flower bed just to the bottom left of my window was a small, humanoid figure with silky, pale skin, completely hairless, standing roughly 4 feet. It was looking in the direction of the shadows and had clearly come from around the left side of the house opposite the porch and had not noticed me as far as I could tell. Its face was devoid of features, save for large round eyes, very reminiscent in shape and color of a bird's eye. It had no nose to speak of and only a small slit for a mouth. It didn't appear to move its mouth as it chirped, sounding more as if noises originated from its throat. It was most certainly not a wild animal, and even more certainly not a child. I was too terrified to move and watched as the creature hopped to the others, and together they scrambled into the woods on the right side of my property. It was clear that there was at least 5 in the group. I have not mentioned this particular incident to my wife. The only other person who I have spoken to about these creatures are yourself and the close friend who introduced me to our mutual friend, Mr. Wrist. I would prefer to keep these things that way and to approach this problem as discreetly as possible. Since that evening, my dog has gone missing from the porch, yet to return. And I can only imagine that his disappearance has to do with these creatures. I've gone looking for him during daylight hours, only to find many of my missing belongings scattered at the entrance to an abandoned mine shaft at the far edge of my property. I don't dare go inside. My friend has convinced me that my experience is similar to that of other visitation experiences, providing me with material and references that back up his claims. I am aware of the outlandish nature of what I have told you, but I am afraid that I have no other explanation for what I have seen, at least at this time. I can see no other option than to seal the entrance to the mine. I cannot achieve this on my own, and I am too frightened to try. I don't dare share this information with others for fear of ruining my career and the reputation of my family. I am prepared to compensate your travel expenses and offer you unrestricted access with whatever recording equipment that you desire, but only on the condition of complete anonymity. Beyond that, I have no other desire than to be rid of this problem. Please inform me of what you would like photographs of and where to send them. Thank you again.
Honestly, this story, reading it, it's really captivating, man. And it has everything in it.
Oh, it gets weirder.
Okay,
the
good.
The stuff that's not written, I mean, it's even weirder. I really don't even know what to think about it, to be honest with you.
I love it.
I don't know.
So, I guess, take us back to after you received that second message from David. He describes events that have pretty much left his family in terror, you know, small hairless entities and someone who calls himself Terry Wrist. Is that how you pronounce it?
I think it's Terry Wrist. Yeah, I think it's a play on the word terrorist is the whole idea there. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, what did you make all of this when you had that second message in front of you?
I thought it was a good story, but I wasn't totally on board. I mean, anyone can write a great story. And I mean, I didn't know who this Terry Wrist guy was. I had no idea who he was talking about. I still had no idea why he was contacting a group of kids on a defunct website for a ghost hunting team that wasn't around. I mean, like I said, we'd never dealt with anything like this before. So none of it made sense to me. And I thought that it was just some kind of elaborate joke. I didn't really take it very seriously until he sent the third email.
Well, let's go back real quick. He mentions for the first time this Terry Wrist character, which could be a play on terrorist. What did that ring any bells at that time? You didn't know this person, did you? Or what did you think about that?
No idea. I had absolutely no idea who this person was. I mean, it seemed like it was clearly a pseudonym for somebody, but it wasn't anything that rang any bells. And so, you know, the first thing I did is I went to Google and I started to see who this person was. It's clearly a play on the word terrorist. And the only references to this guy, Terry Wrist, was this guy in the back of a couple he was listed in some obscure 90s books about UFOs. They were written by a guy, he's an occultist by the name of Alan Greenfield. And in these books, he interviews this guy going by the pseudonym Terry Wrist, who claimed that he had been part of a group of Vietnam veterans who spent their time going into alien cave bases located underground and clearing them out of little creatures that sounded quite a bit like the ones that David was experiencing.
Wow.
It's the only reference I can find to this guy, Terry R. Wrist. So, you know, again, still kind of hard to swallow for me.
Wow. And in his conversations with Alan Greenfield, I mean, does Terry report anything similar to David's account or just like the noises or what?
There was no reference that I remember to any of the noises. The description sounded a lot like, you know, the typical grays, which a lot of what David sound, you know, a lot of what David was talking about sounded a little bit like grays too. But the one thing that really stuck out was the fact that these things were living in underground. They were coming out of old mine shafts. They had underground cave bases, and that's where they lived. And that's where he and this group of badass alien ass kickers, they'd go down and they'd wipe these places out, kind of like David wanted us to do.
Oh my gosh, that's a movie. Why hasn't that happened yet? Or like a weird
comic
book?
I'd read it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So was this ringing a bell with Kentucky? Was there evidence that there were mines, that this was a possibility to be a thing?
I mean, you know, I'd never been to Kentucky at this point. Mm-hmm. I'd never visited Kentucky. I knew nothing about Kentucky. The only thing that it seemed to have anything in common with was there were some themes that related to the Hopkinsville Goblins case that happened back in 1955. Hmm. And in 1955, this family in this farmhouse was besieged by these tiny creatures that they thought were from outer space. And it still remains like one of the most well-documented cases of extraterrestrial contact, because police saw this. I mean, there were 11 witnesses that saw this. They fired on the creatures. They've got sketches from different eyewitnesses. So the themes of like these creatures coming out, being interested in the children specifically, looking in windows at night, and then kind of disappearing off into the forest, sounded a lot like what David was going through.
Wow.
But in my head, it was like, well, how does this, you know, connect? The thing is, the place that this was all supposed to be happening to David was far eastern Kentucky.
Hmm.
And where Hopkinsville happened was pretty far western Kentucky, so hundreds of miles.
Well, at that point, with that sort of information, you emailed Dave, right, and requested some evidence for the second time. You know, I think in the article you mentioned that you reiterated that if he was, you know, truly serious about having you come to Kentucky, you know, right, you needed some pretty solid proof that you weren't being jerked around, and he didn't reply for quite some time. Is that right?
No, I think it was several weeks, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at that point, I'd given up. I was like, yeah, whatever. That was a joke, you know, because that's how a lot of this happens. You ask for evidence and no one can produce it. And then lo and behold, several weeks later, I get another email from him. And in the email were a bunch of attachments to pictures of three-toed footprints. I mean, they were clear as day. And the strangest part is, you know, at this point, I'd never investigated anything like this before. I had pretty much strictly stuck to ghosts and poltergeists and even a little bit of Bigfoot. And what I picked up from hanging out with some Bigfoot hunters was, you know, they always look for the dermal ridges.
Sure.
And these had dermal ridges. It was really striking. And so at this point, I was like, all right, I'm on board.
Wow. That's amazing. And so what did you end up doing with these photographs when he sent them? Did you get any other input, or was there anything else besides dermal ridges that rang out to you, or basically what was your next step with this?
Well, the first thing I did is I sent them to anybody I knew who was a Bigfoot investigator or who worked with animals on a regular basis. And I said, you know, is there a kind of animal that can make this track? There wasn't. No one could find anything that looked anything like it. I said, you know, have there been sightings of three-toed creatures in this area? Could this possibly be fake? And, you know, one of the things the Bigfoot hunter said was, you know, we've seen three-toed Bigfoot footprints, but we don't know what it's going to be. We can't tell how big they are. So they couldn't tell how big these footprints were. So like, we can't tell and measure them against what we know about three-toed Bigfoots. But we can tell you this, they look very real. They don't look like something that someone could have faked very easily. And so, you know, that was just more ammo for me to actually go, all right, well, this is worth looking into.
And at that point, did you exchange any more emails with David?
Yeah, I sent him another email back. And I think at this point it was like, yeah, I believe you. Okay. All right. All right. You convinced me enough. I said, you know, send more pictures, send photos that show how big these are. And, you know, for God's sake, try and get the creatures. You know, if you're seeing these so often, do your best to try and get a photo of these actual creatures. And it wasn't too long before he sent another email. And this one did have more photographs. And he has a ruler next to the footprint, so you can see that these things were about half a foot.
Wow.
So clearly they weren't the three-toed Bigfoot footprints, because these were very small. On some of the images, the dermal ridges are even more visible. And the weirdest part about what he'd sent in this email was he actually did include images of the creatures.
What?
He actually had photos of the goblins themselves.
What did they look like? How clear were these? What did they look like?
In true paranormal fashion, not clear at all.
So
the most compelling image shows what looks to be like a small, pale humanoid figure that looks like it is kind of crouched around a tree looking out towards the camera. And when David had taken these photos, he said that he actually got them from his back porch, took as many as he possibly could. And then he and his brother-in-law actually hit the road. And they said, we're not sticking around. I'm done with this. There were some other photos in there, too. One of them looks almost show like a side profile of the creatures. I mean, again, it's pretty blurry. But when you look at it, you can see what looks like the side profile of what looks like a typical gray alien. You can see like the high cheeks and the pointed head and the big round dark eye. So, you know, at this point, I'm absolutely all in. I want to know more. I want to go down. One of the last things that he's expressed was that he wanted us to blow up the mine.
That was just a piece of a much longer interview that can be found right now in a special Patreon members-only feed at patreon.com/euphemet. But again, that's not all members can listen to. Next week, we'll be dropping our first episode of our new long-form interview series, House of Mystic Mirrors. In the first episode, we dig deep into Memphis Hoodoo with writer Tony Kale, and here for you now is an excerpt of that very talk. You mentioned meeting a root worker. Can you explain a little bit about that, what this person did, you know, what they do as a practice?
Sure. My initial meeting was through a friend of mine that I had gone to grade school with and learned about her through a friend. I had known the family for years, but had no idea about the lady in the family who practiced. And until I was told by a local that there was a woman at a small convenience store out in a rural area of West Tennessee that was known to come into the store, and she would walk in and she'd shake her keys, and she would walk around the perimeter of the store, and she would announce to everyone in the store that there's no more voodoo in here. Not long afterwards, there was a local county judge who was in this particular store, and he was complaining about an injury that he had received, and his knee was giving him a lot of trouble. And locals say that this little African-American elderly lady who had been coming to the store shaking her keys here and there said, you know, I've got something for you. I think I can help you out. So she left the store and returned with a small jar of some type of herbal salve. And she told the judge, she said, put this on your knee and I promise you, you'll feel better. And the word was that in a few days, the judge came back and said, you know, he was no longer experiencing pain and that whatever this woman had given him had worked. So I set it upon myself to go find this lady. And again, I didn't know at that point that I'd known her family for years, and it was a friend of mine's grandmother. I went and visited her in a little bitty small wooden house out in a very rural part of West Tennessee, and I go to her door, and there's this little lady in a gingham dress and has a little head covering, and she invites me in, and I just asked her. I said, I understand you do some healing. And she says, you know, I try to help people all I can, and God has given me this gift that I use, and also my father and my uncle taught me how to use it. And she is just that. She was a root worker. She would use herbs, she would use roots and plants local to the area, combined with spiritual wisdom to help others. And she was the real deal. She didn't charge for her services. Typically families might bring her food, and things she needed, but, she didn't charge for her services, and she wasn't in it for the money. She, practiced because she believed she was called to that work, as historically we have seen a lot of traditional root workers. And that is they feel this spiritual calling, to this particular folk tradition.
Very interesting. You know, I wonder how much of the knowledge of hoodoo, especially in terms of how to practice it, right, is just passed down generationally. Is that the most common way?
You know, that seems to be a very common way. It definitely has seemed to be an oral tradition. You know, we do have books, and there actually was a period in history where a lot of hoodoo artifacts became commercialized. Mm-hmm. And there are some academics that sort of look at that time as the watering down of the hoodoo culture. But the true practices that we have seen historically among root workers and conjurers do appear to be oral traditions passed on through the generations and through sometimes from healer to apprentice. Yeah, it definitely does seem to be an oral tradition.
Yeah, what a strong impact that can make on the practitioners when someone they respect or someone they look up to or someone they're related to passes down, like, really these access points to alleged powers, right?
Absolutely. You know, the one of the people that I write about in the book in the closing chapter on the future of hoodoo is I mention a local conjurer that we call Doc Macon. And that's not his real name, but that's the name we gave him in the text. And but Doc Macon actually shared the story about when he was a child. He was born. He was born with the umbilical cord, his mother's umbilical cord, connecting with him around his neck, and she believed him to be dead, and so she placed him actually in a ditch and left him for dead. Well, his grandmother, who was a root worker, said she knew that he wasn't dead, and so she went and found him, and she took care of him, cleaned him up, and raised him. And he said that she passed on her traditions to him. And he said that, she told him that he was born with the veil and, that he did have the cowl over his face. And this was an indicator that he was spiritually, empowered. And she taught her traditions that she was raised, to teach to him and pass them on, and he still practices them today. And his heritage is Native American, Southern Tennessee, with a little bit of Native American, and but he definitely carries that on as well. So yeah, definitely, I think the apprentice receiving the blessing from the teacher is definitely a powerful aspect.
One of the things I personally like about Euphemet is that it allows a freedom to explore a very wide range of the strange, and I think that is what members can expect for our Patreon content, in addition to being a part of an inner circle. Members will have exclusive access to guests and myself via group hangouts online, things like Patreon Lens, and exclusive commentary and articles. My hope is that it becomes a great option for those listeners that have asked for more, and that we can continue building this and telling more of these important stories together. Thanks so much for listening to this Patreon announcement, and I hope everyone enjoyed this week's debut of Obscura. We'll be back next week, but until then, keep looking up.